Where do we go from here? Was the theme and title of a speech that Dr. King gave at a Southern Christian Leadership Council conference in Atlanta in 1967. Another way this could have been stated is to ask, what is our vision of justice? Reverend King is most often celebrated for his struggles in ending segregation in the South. But his dissatisfaction with the status quo extended far beyond segregation. Much to the dismay of Lyndon Baines Johnson, he criticized the Vietnam War. But even more significantly, he criticized the economic structure of our country. His reflection, I think, is powerful these many years later. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. Times have changed since the 60s. De jure segregation by the force of law is no longer with us. But de facto segregation created by economic inequality is still present, perhaps even more so. Every Sunday at All Souls Church Unitarian in Washington, D.C., where I am a member, the worship associate explains at the beginning of every service that their mission is to help create what Dr. King called the beloved community. The beloved community is a community of radical inclusion. It is a community where all God's children are welcome and live in right relationship with one another, where people of all races, all classes, all genders and ethnicities, all sexual orientations have come together to form a community of inclusion, of respect, of care. But that can't happen when so many are so poor they can't meet their basic needs. That can't happen when some have excellent health care while others have none. That can't happen when some have jobs that don't pay a living wage, where others have jobs that allow them to buy expensive luxuries. That can't happen when the top 1% earn on average more than $1 million a year, where the bottom 90% earn on average only $32,000 a year. In 1973, the 99% share of the total income of the country was 92.3%. It's been falling steadily ever since. Today, it's 82.6%, almost 10% less. Ronald Reagan is held up as an exemplar by many for his cutting taxes, and he did lower the marginal tax rate for income tax. But what's not held up very often is that he also raised the capital gains tax rate from 20% to 28%. Because he said it's not fair that someone who earns their living by the sweat of their brow pays more in taxes than someone who lives off investments. Warren Buffett's taxes in 1986 would have been at least as high as the secretary's under Reagan's tax policy. We could use a little bit of that today, I think. Today, the capital gains tax rate is only 15%, even lower than it was during Reagan's term at the beginning, before he raised it. We can't create the beloved community when some couples are excluded because their sexual orientation is to the same sex instead of the opposite sex. 19 states ban any legal recognition of same-sex unions. North Carolina and Minnesota will hold voter referendums this year that threaten to do the same. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was finally repealed in the U.S. military, but the military still does not recognize same-sex spouses, so gay and lesbian families cannot receive any benefits, including housing or health care. Transgender service members are still barred from serving. We can't create the beloved community when some Americans seek to prevent Muslims from building mosques. We can't create it when Lowe's Home Improvement, one of the sponsors of a reality TV show on the Learning Channel featuring American Muslims, withdrew its ads because a conservative group, the Florida Family Association, claimed the show was, quote, propaganda that riskily hides the Islamic agenda's clear and present danger to America's liberty and traditional values. We can't create it when Muslims are portrayed as terrorists in official FBI training manuals. We can't create the beloved community when a program of mass detention and deportation results in the deportation of 400,000 undocumented immigrants each year. The so-called secure communities of Department of Homeland Security is supposed to make our communities more secure by identifying and deporting undocumented immigrants who have committed violent crimes, serious crimes. Instead, what's happening, though, is exporting people who have only offense is a minor traffic violation, who got pulled over for not signaling they're going to turn left. Often the only crime is that they re-entered the country after having been previously deported. The result is that most undocumented immigrants are afraid to go to the police now under any circumstance, even when they are the victims of crime. One of the reasons our violent crime rate has been dropping in our country over the last decade is because of community policing. But community policing can't work when the community doesn't trust the police. We can't create the beloved community when water of some people is polluted by mountaintops having been removed to mine coal or by hydrofracking to extract natural gas. The extracting of oil from the tar sands of northern Alberta has resulted in not only significantly increased incidences of rare cancers in the First Nations people living downstream, but in the destruction of their entire way of life. The government of Canada has, in effect, decided that these people and their lands are expendable. That is why I was arrested protesting the Keystone XL pipeline last August. And we can't create the beloved community when the effects of global warming are already displacing people from low-lying areas all around the world as the seas rise because the ice is melting. I told a story in the first service about how difficult it was for Martin Luther King Jr. after Montgomery. He found it hard to replicate that success. He was a great preacher, in demand, but he soon learned that no matter how well he spoke, that wasn't enough. So he tried other routes. He went to the National Baptist Convention, of which his church was a member. 10,000 ministers were members. Reverend J.H. Jackson, though, was the so-called Negro Pope who was in charge of it, and he resisted King's efforts. And it went finally excommunicated Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from the National Baptist Convention. Unimaginable. 2,000 of his colleagues, though, did resign in protest, but it still didn't make a difference. The convention held firm, did not take up his cause, did not endorse it. White clergy opposed it, and the famous letter from Birmingham jail was prompted when a group of 8 white liberal clergymen in Alabama, led by the white Episcopal bishop of that state, wrote a statement to Dr. King saying, "Oh, you're trying to do too much too soon. You're unwise and untimely." So it was in that context that he decided to go and take on Birmingham, Alabama, the bastion of segregation, with his vicious police chief, Bull Connor. And so it was that one day on a Good Friday, he turned up in his jail clothes and got arrested and went to the jail. And it was there he saw the letter from the white clergyman reported in the paper. And it was there, much to his lawyer's dismay, he started composing a response, which became known as the letter from Birmingham jail. But even then, after he got out, he went and tried to organize protests in Birmingham. On a day when they were expecting hundreds to risk arrest, only 4 got arrested. Can you imagine how discouraging it must have been? How hopeless his cause must have seemed? It was then that they decided to go and use the children. High school students at first, then middle school, then finally children as young as 6 were arrested. New York Times showed a picture of a high school student being attacked by a German shepherd, lunging at his bare belly. After that picture was published, the New York Times wrote more in the next year about civil rights than it had before in total. Changed everything. King said that what was required was unmerited suffering being displayed as a result of the policies. Well, unmerited suffering was indeed displayed, and the nation was moved and changed its heart. I'm impressed by the sacrifice, courage, and vision of those involved in that epic struggle. But it's clear to me, as it was to King, that talking the talk isn't enough, no matter how eloquent we may be. We must also walk the walk. Kat Liu, who is a member of the Witness Ministries team, which I direct for the UUA, told me recently that the pages most visited on the UUA website that we maintain, the social justice pages, the parts that explain the background of things are the ones that are most visited. I thought to myself, well, that's not surprising. We love to study things. We love to learn things. But learning isn't enough. Just like great preaching isn't enough, you have to do something. The metaphor I like to use is that of cooking. I like to cook. I like to read recipe books. But you know, if you're going to be a cook, you got to do more than just study the recipes. You got to cook. Now, I know this congregation is a member of the Northern Virginia congregationally based community organization called Voice. Can I hear a shout out for Voice?
Yeah!
Now, Voice cooks. I was very impressed with the assembly, and I was at the General Assembly in Salt Lake City with Reverend Linda Olson Peebles, and we showcased that to the whole denomination, the founding assembly of Voice. It was very moving, and I was very pleased to read about the recent action that was held at which Senator Mark Warner was present along with Bank of America executives, and you held them accountable. And your minister, the Reverend Nancy McDonald Ladd, played a key role in that, was up on the stage as a leader. I was so pleased to see that. In the 18 years I served First Jefferson Church in Fort Worth, Texas, I was very involved with the IAF affiliate there. IAF stands for Industrial Areas Foundation. Voice is part of that network, as is ACT in Tarrant County. The experience I gained from working with ACT is why I'm in the role I'm in today. One of the core teachings of IAF is that there are two kinds of power in the world. Some of you probably know this. Organized money and organized people. Now, we don't have much money, but we got a lot of people we can ally ourselves with. But many people, particularly people of faith, are ambivalent about power. It doesn't seem religious to talk about power. Allow me to quote from Dr. King again, because he ran into the same problem. Now, power, properly understood, he wrote, is nothing but the ability to achieve purpose. It is the strength required to bring about social, political, and economic change. Walter Reuther defined power one day. He said, power is the ability of a labor union like the UAW to make the most powerful corporation in the world, General Motors, say yes when it wants to say no. That's power. One of the great problems of history, he continued, is that the concepts of love and power have usually been contrasted as opposites. Polar opposites, in that love is identified with a resignation of power and power with a denial of love. It was this misinterpretation that caused Nietzsche, who is a philosopher of the will to power, to reject the Christian concept of love. It was this same misinterpretation which induced Christian theologians to reject the Nietzschean philosophy of the will to power in the name of the Christian idea of love. What is needed, King said, is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice. And justice at its best is power, correcting everything that stands against love. I like that last phrase. Power at its best is implementing the demands of injustice, and justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. One of the things that falls under Witness Ministries, by the way, is the Standing on the Side of Love campaign. And I just posted a blog on the subject of Guantanamo Bay. It just came out Saturday. Go check it out and read it. And today marks the beginning of a recognition of the campaign of 30 days of love. And not love in the romantic sense, but love in the sense of love for one's neighbor. 30 Days of Love begins today, Martin Luther King Sunday, and ends on Valentine's Day. So we've got a calendar, something to do. You can even pledge to go to General Assembly in Phoenix and stand on the side of love there as we witness against the abusive policies of Sheriff Joe Arpaio and SB 1070. When I was in Fort Worth, I participated in a campaign with ACT to change the policies of the public hospitals. The public hospital in Tarrant County, John Peter Smith, was different in its policy than all the other county hospitals of all the other urban counties in Texas. The urban counties are where Houston is, where Austin is, Dallas, San Antonio, and El Paso. All those other counties, if people, regardless of their citizenship status, qualified on the basis of their income, which was 200% of the federal poverty limit or less, they could go to see a doctor in a clinic for $5. Now that's affordable health care. Now, 200% of the federal poverty limit a few years ago, I don't know what it is now, but a few years ago, was roughly $40,000 or less for a family of four. So we tried, the county commissioners appointed the managers who made the decision, the managers of the hospital, but they didn't directly control them. Toward the end of the campaign, we almost got there. We got 4 out of the 9 votes we need. We just needed one more and we could have changed the policy. They're still working on it. They may have achieved it. I think I probably would have heard, though. But what we did achieve was a significant increase in that threshold at which people would get affordable health care. And we got it to go from 200 to 250%, then from 250 to 300, there was a sliding scale, which roughly means that people who now made $50,000 or less with a family of four could go and see the doctor for $5 in the public health network. Think how many hundreds, if not thousands, of people in Tarrant County with 2 million people qualified under this new policy. That was an exercise that was very gratifying. And what was most gratifying, or very gratifying, not most, but very gratifying, was that the paper, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, in an editorial, congratulated the hospital on deciding to become a public hospital again, and also gave ACT credit. They said, as much as we appreciate this policy, it's clear to us that they never would have done it unless ACT had coerced them. Now, that's a power word, isn't it? Coerce them. So we did that. We were correcting something that stood against love. It's difficult to imagine that faith communities can gain enough power to affect the social problems that face us today. It was difficult to imagine it back then, too. Yet it was faith communities who overcame that legacy of institutionalized segregation and discrimination. In the early 90s, First Jefferson Church in Fort Worth was part of a coalition that eventually won the inclusion of gays and lesbians as a protected class in the Civil Rights Ordinance of Fort Worth, Texas. In 2010, an effort that started while I was still serving that church, they were part of a coalition that successfully expanded that to include people of by gender identity and gender expression, which broadly speaking means transgendered persons. And even more significantly, they were able to get benefits for couples who weren't married, including pension and health care. Didn't matter what the couple's sexual orientation was. That's a huge victory. If the faith communities involved in the civil rights struggles of the 1960s hadn't organized, if they hadn't joined and supported the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, if the members of the churches hadn't supported their leaders and organizations, they would never have overcome. It is the same with us. Unless we actively engage with groups like Voice, with our brothers and sisters in other faith communities, Catholics and Jews, evangelical Christians and Muslims, we will not be able to create a community where all of God's children can be free. Unless we join hands with our brothers and sisters of every economic station, we will not be able to create a community where all God's children can find a place in the sun. Unless we join hands with our brothers and sisters of every race, sexual orientation, and ethnicity, we will not be able to create a community where all God's children can be welcomed and free. This is what is required to create the beloved community, a vision that was compelling then and I find compelling yet still today. This is my vision of justice. I hope and pray that it may be your vision as well.